Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBA 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Welcome back. And now joining us is Catherine Ramsland. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to our talk.
So I noticed you're working on more books as usual, and you've got a new one coming out with Mark Safarik, Spree Killers. What made you do that?
That actually came out this week.
Oh, it did?
So it's out. It's sitting right here in front of me. And what made me do it?
Yeah.
That is an interesting question, because Mark Safarik, a former FBI profiler, had been part of an FBI initiative to bring together all kinds of serial killer experts, because they wanted to relook at their definition of a serial killer, since they had many complaints over the years. And so they brought in all these experts in 2005, and Mark was part of the organizational committee. And in this meeting, they removed spree killer from the multicide classification system, because they thought it really had no use for law enforcement. And I teach a course on extreme offenders, and I thought they were totally wrong about that, because there is a different psychology for a spree killer than for a mass murderer, which is at least four murders in a single locale, pretty short-lived incident, versus serial killers, which is now, according to the new definition, at least two murders in two different events, and then spree killers, which is sort of like a mass murderer strung out over geography and over time. So there's a different psychology, so it was relevant to my class. Anyway, Mark and I would get together from time to time and discuss this, because he agreed with me it was a mistake. So all of a sudden, in 2018, this killer in Arizona began moving around, picking off people who were related to his divorce, him as Dwight Lehman Jones. He killed a forensic psychiatrist who had said he'd be dangerous. Obviously right. He killed the two paralegals who were in the law office of the attorney for his wife. He killed a life coach who was in an office that had something to do with counseling for his son. So his ex-wife had married a police officer who had been her bodyguard, who were able to alert Scottsdale police, this is the guy. We're sure this is the guy, and we know where he's living. And when the police then went to where he was staying, he killed himself. They were able to stop that by identifying him and going there. And, of course, he had more on his list, notably his ex-wife, her new husband, and possibly his son. So we realize this is the perfect case for what we want to say, why we want to say there is practicality for law enforcement in understanding spree killers. This took place over several days. They had enough time to mobilize and figure out who they were looking for, go find him, stop him. And so we decided to build a database of spree killers. We thought we were going to stop around 100. We got well over 400 from 43 countries, and then applied a classification system, which had never been done for spree killers. And in that classification system, we were able to see that the kind of killer that is what I'm talking about, where law enforcement can actually prepare, was actually our largest classification. So that's our argument. The book is something we would want the FBI to see to realize spree killer belongs in the multi-site classification system. So that's a long explanation, but that's really how the book was born.
Wow. Now, spree killers, now, so for people that listening, spree killer is different than a serial killer in the what they're doing. And also, generally, spree killers kind of plan on killing themselves as well. Isn't that right?
Well, they don't necessarily, because some of them actually just get arrested. We're not sure if they ever had suicidal intent. But what's different from a spree and serial is that you usually know who the spree killer is because they've launched into a spree. The hard thing is just where are they now? You know, how do you figure out where they are so you can find them and stop them? They don't have, I mean, one of the things the FBI did during this meeting was to remove one of the aspects of the serial killer definition was a cooling off period. And, for a serial killer. And they decided to remove that because nobody really knew what that meant. But I think it actually does mean something because that is kind of a difference between serial killers and spree killers is that cooling off period. Spree killers are sort of on the run. They're still in the grip of the precipitating incident and they just keep moving around until eventually they're stopped. Often they get into a shootout with police. Is that suicidal? We really don't know for sure unless they have a suicide note in their pocket. But, yeah, a lot of them don't survive their spree. But some have and have been arrested. And we've had a few actually who were arrested and then hanged themselves in their prison cell, you know, within the year. So they were suicidal. But we've had another one that we saw was, I think, in Louisiana, where this I think he was maybe 19 or 20, he had been kicked out of his parents' home. He moved in with a girlfriend, and then all of a sudden, his name was Dakota Thoreau, and all of a sudden, apparently something went wrong, so he killed the girlfriend and her family, took their truck, went to his parents, killed both of them, and disappeared. So law enforcement was faced with, well, we know who it is for sure. We don't know where he's going, but we do know he doesn't have much in the way of resources. So how can we figure out where he might be going? And they realized he had a grandmother a few hours away. So they were able to alert her, move her to a hotel, and then wait there at the property. And he, in fact, did drive in, and they were able to put him under arrest. So that's exactly the kind of case we're talking about.
What tends to be the key things, like what causes someone to do a spree killing, a mass shooting? Is it generally something political or some formula like that?
Well, we actually, when we did the classification system, we did it largely on motive. So the first, our largest category was anger and revenge. Mm-hmm. They like the Dwight Lehman Jones case in Arizona, he was angry at his ex-wife. She had gotten full custody of their son, and she was actually giving him a load of money for, you know, in their divorce, but I don't know, he just was angry, and he'd gone on YouTube or somewhere and done a bunch of ranting kinds of videos. So we knew that he was angry and punitive. So for him, it was anger and revenge. But we have some who are on a mission. And in the mission category, we had psychotic mission and non-psychotic mission. And the non-psychotic mission tended to be more political or hate crimes or something like that, where the person isn't really psychotic, but they still, you know, feel as if they have to eliminate a certain group of people, like the guys who go to the synagogues or something like that, or the New Zealand killer who had gone from one place to another. And they were able to stop him because he put his whole plan onto his social media account, which isn't very bright, but at any rate, I guess he thought, you know, they wouldn't see it in time for him to complete his mission. So that was the second category. Then there's deadly desperation. And these are people who are usually cornered. They're caught maybe living, you know, having said they were college professors or something, and really they weren't. And that eventually it caught up to them, and they just explode and start shooting people. Mental illness is another category. And this usually is, you know, pretty serious mental illness like psychosis. A good representative of that was Herbert Mullen in Santa Cruz in 1972 and 73, where he decided he needed to kill 13 people in order to save California from earthquake and tsunami. And so he realized he was going to get these 13, but they'd be willing to sacrifice because they would telepathically sing the die song to him, and then he'd kill them. As it turned out, he did get exactly 13, and California still is where it is. So maybe he wasn't so psychotic, but at any rate, he certainly had a psychotic sort of idea about what he needed to do. Another very large category is robbery and thrill. Mm-hmm. We put these two together because sometimes it's really only robbery, but quite often robbery and thrill went together. So if they started out, you know, robbing a gas station and killing somebody and then went on to another one and another one, often the robbery and thrill kinds of stuff went together. This is the category in which we see where we find females involved. It's usually involved as a team on the robbery thrill side of things.
Like Starkweather, for example.
Well, Starkweather, he's a classic spree killer. And Carol Ann Fugate went with him, but, you know, and she then said, well, she was in fear of her life. I think that's not true because she had plenty of chances to get away if she really was in fear for her life. But yeah, she would be like that. Many of the ones who were on teams didn't do any of the killings. At some point, Starkweather said, you know, he kept going back and forth, but he did say that she's the one who killed Carol King, which is one of the victims. And that wouldn't be so far-fetched considering that she could have viewed Carol King as a rival or something, but we don't know that she killed anybody. We do have a few females. One was in the psychotic category. One was in what we call murder in tight locations. So it's a spree, but maybe it's contained in a certain building, like the person went from room to room to room from floor to floor to floor. And we have one woman represented there, a couple women in the psychotic categories, but mostly the females largely were in the robbery and thrill categories.
Now, I was going to say, what about the Vegas shooter, you know, Stephen Paddock? They never did find a reason for him, did they?
No, but he's considered a mass murderer. He's very pretty classic in that sense. I think that even though we don't have a very clear reason why he did what he did, you can kind of see the build-up to just a pretty disgruntled guy who was kind of punitive and decided, you know, he had amassed all this equipment. He possibly, I mean, they didn't find any kind of brain damage or anything like that. I mean, it seemed like he was a grudge carrier. We do have people like that who just decide one day they're gonna shoot people. But in terms of a motive, we really didn't find anything that we could put our finger on that he actually stated or that anyone he knew about. So, no, not at this point.
So what kind of audience were you hoping you'd get from this book?
Well, the full title is Spree Killers, Practical Classifications for Law Enforcement and Criminology. We certainly want law enforcement to be in our audience because we did this for them. We have a whole chapter in this where it's tips for law enforcement. So here we have given you the categories. We have a chapter where we analyze. We do a lot of data analytics of, you know, all the various statistics and groupings and whatnot. But primarily, our whole thrust for this book was to show law enforcement that if they could identify the type of spree killer they're dealing with, then they possibly could respond to it effectively and stop a spree before it completes itself and save some people. So that's the primary audience, but also criminology, because many criminologists have gone along with the FBI idea that the spree killer really doesn't have much use to us, and we hope to change their minds in that. And then, of course, forensic psychology, because that's the field I'm in. I think that it's really important because the spree killer dynamics psychologically are quite different from a mass murderer and a serial killer.
Wow. So who influenced you the most?
In my whole life?
In your whole life. No, I was going to say more for the writing and for the when you sit down to write a book, who's inspired you? Like, do you like other writers?
I really never set out to be a writer. I know a lot of writers believe, you know, from childhood, this is what I want to do. It never was something I set out to want to do. But in fact, the very first book I wrote was on a philosopher called Kierkegaard, and I thought, I never want to write another book. But then I wrote a biography of Anne Rice and a biography of Dean Koontz, and I really enjoyed the commercial writing process a lot more than academics. And then I went undercover in the vampire subculture, and I wrote a book, and then it got really fun. So books upon books. I think now around 67 books.
Wow.
For a person who never wanted to be a writer, it looks like I did want to be a writer after all. Who influenced me? I guess my favorite writer was Dostoevsky. But again, I didn't aspire to be a writer, so I can't say that was an influence on my decision to do this.
Was it Crime and Punishment specifically?
Well, no, actually, that's my least favorite of his. Oh. I like The Brothers Karamazov. I like The Idiot far better than Crime and Punishment. I thought Crime and Punishment just was not well done.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I know, I'm in the minority on that because it's the classic, but Brothers Karamazov is far better book, I think.
What do you think your biggest accomplishment is, or you're most proud of?
I think the book I did with Dennis Rader, where I spent 5 years, getting at the heart of a serial killer's developmental trajectory, the story he wanted to tell about himself and his crimes, was very intense. And I kind of put that together with another book right before I got the opportunity to write with Rader. I had written a book called The Mind of a Murderer, where I looked back over a century of what psychologists had brought to the table in terms of studying extreme offenders, mass murderers or serial killers, or spree killers. And I had found a dozen cases of psychologists or some kind of mental health expert who had spent a great deal of time with somebody, with one of the killers, and really plumbed the depths. And as that book was going to publication, suddenly I got the opportunity to do exactly what I had just been studying. So I think that pair of books is probably the greatest contribution that I have done in my writing. That's what I would guess.
In the new Spree Killer book, what did you like most about it?
Well, it was funny because when we first started putting together, we just said, let's look at some other cases, which we did, and then it just kept growing. Like, we'd have 25, and then the next week we'd have 45, and then it was up to 100. And I said, I think this could be a book. I contacted an editor that I'd recently worked with at CRC Press and said, do you think this could be a book? He said, yeah, we're interested. And we just kept collecting cases. And I'll just say it right now, Mark did the majority. He contacted people in law enforcement in other countries that he had worked with. And, before I knew it, we had 43 countries represented in this. We were both astonished. I got a student of mine to do an independent study where she helped us with all the Excel charts and all the data analytics of this. It just kept growing and growing. And what was kind of exciting was we were really working with raw material. And I think that's what I always like about writing. I don't want to do stuff I've already done. I don't want to do stuff that other people have already done. I want to plow through new territory because there's a real amazing sense of raw experience when you're very close to information that nobody's really ever put through the process of analysis and theory and all of that. You're really there. You're a pioneer. You're exploring on your own and, figuring this stuff out for yourself. And I find that the most exciting aspect of writing. If I'm, like with Dennis Rader, I created the guided autobiography. I knew the kind of story I wanted to tell. There wasn't any genre for it. So I made one. And that's exciting. That's the fun part of writing is you're creating something that has not been done before. You're putting it into expression to communicate with others. And hopefully that communication is going to end up being important in some manner. And if it does become important, you've accomplished something.
Were you surprised at how many spree killers there were, that you, how many cases you were finding?
Not so surprised as, I think I was more surprised at the diversity among them in terms of their motives and whatnot. I mean, I figured there probably were at least 100. I didn't think there'd be over 400, but, and that's counting them, you know, as teams. So of the spree incidents, it was 329 and 419 killers, because some of the teams were even five people. You know, we had a few. I think there was one in Pittsburgh that was five people or something like that. But you know, I guess it wasn't. I didn't really think about how many spree killers there were, so it wasn't a surprise. But I think that was a surprise that we actually ended up having enough material for a book. And this is not the kind of book a true crime reader is going to want. It's not a narrative. It's more of a reference kind of book. I mean, you'll get every single killer has at least a paragraph of what he did. A few of them get longer, like Starkweather is a good example, get longer renditions because they represent a certain type and they represent it well. So they might get two or three pages. But it's not like a true crime narrative, you know, where you get this beginning, middle, and end. It's really lists and lists within classification systems analyzed. So our primary audience is really law enforcement and criminologists.
Do you think law enforcement needs more training in this area then, or?
Absolutely, because they've already been told by the FBI this isn't worth their time. We don't even want this category in the books anymore, and now we want to retrain them to think differently because they have actually put our procedures into place without realizing it. So the one with the Dakota Thoreau case. They're faced with, you know, five people dead, a truck missing, a gun missing. Where's this guy going? Who's next? And they have to plan and think proactively about how to, first of all, protect potential people in this person's pathway, but also how can they stop them? And they did a good job with that. So I think they already kind of get it, but if we are able to give them. And we've presented this already to some conferences where law enforcement were present, and they do find the tips to be very useful.
Now, when you say spree killers from around the world, do you find that spree killers in other countries do it differently?
Well, that was interesting because Mark thought that was what it was going to be. He thought you would not find spree killers using guns, and he was wrong. We actually found a lot of spree killers using guns. I think the only place they didn't was perhaps the UK. They use knives more often than anything else, but we were surprised, and also he thought we were going to find an older group of spree killers would be older in other countries, but that turned out not to be the case either. So we get these stereotypes playing in our head of the kind of person you might think would be a spree killer, and we got very surprised. There was one guy, I think one of my favorite cases was this, and terrible case at that, but in terms of it being extremely unique, when I say favorite, I mean because it stands out to me, was a guy, I can't think of it, which country it was, but he had worked in a like a center for disability where people, it was a residential center. And he formed this idea that these people should be eliminated because it would save the government money and that money could be put to more productive uses. He began to write letters to officials about this idea, and he proposed himself as the agent of this, that he would be happy to go and eliminate all these people on behalf of the government, and everybody would be better off, including the disabled people. Well, they brought him in thinking, oh my God, this guy's got problems, and they evaluated him, and he was you know, held for a couple months, and then eventually they really couldn't keep holding him for any reason. And he went right out and he put his plan in place. He started, he went to one of the places he had been working at and went from room to room killing people with, I think, an axe or something.
Oh, wow.
It's a horrible case. But what a bizarre notion that a person, and he's in the mentally ill sector for good reason. What a bizarre notion that he's doing the state a favor by saving them money on people that he sees as being of no worth. And that, and so, oh no, he's in the admission. He's in the mission category because he had this mission, but he's in the psychotic part of the mission category because his plan is absolutely, you know, detached from any sense of humanity. But he firmly believed he was right. He was justified in this mission. And so he stands out to me in part because for him, the clarity of his plan was, you know, so distinct from the typical thing that we see in spree killers who are usually kind of compelled into their spree. For him, it was planned out. He got weapons. He knew exactly how to disable the people at the door, which door to go in, at what time of night would be best. The clarity of his plan was really distinct from what you would ordinarily think of as a spree killer. And he really was psychotic, but still so rational in the way he was going about doing it. So he stands out to me as a really unusual case, but he's definitely a spree killer.
Wow. So what else have you got in the works now for you?
Well, I'm doing edits right now on How to Catch a Serial Killer, a book that will probably be coming out in the spring, and I have 30 cases where law enforcement or forensic innovation really made the difference in how a serial killer was identified and captured.
Wow. Well, we're going to have Mark Safrick on the show next week. So, any
oh, good. Well,
any secrets? You have any?
You know, he'll be great. What are you going to have him talk about? This book?
Well, probably the book. Probably some of his other work. Do you have any good secrets about him? Or
I'd never tell if I did. Are you kidding?
Oh,
Mark is
good for you. Don't throw your co-writer under the bus.
I tell you though, he was great to work with because you know he hadn't written a book before, and I'm a type of writer like I just want to get this done and get this off my plate, and so. My other co-writers have always talked about the whip I hold over their head. And in a way, I'm like that because I should get this done. Let's move. And Mark was very good about that. I mean, he even though he's also learning the process along the way, which is his own challenge, you know, he was very good about here's a case. What do you think about this case? He was great to work with. He's a really good co-author. I'm very happy we have this book. I feel really, really privileged to have worked with him. And so, yeah, no secrets. I think he was fabulous.
Well,
I have one question. I'm just about to write my first book as a first time true crime writer. What is your advice? Do you have any piece of advice that you can give me?
Well, is it a true crime narrative type of book that you want readers to be hooked by and is a page-turner type, or is it more, can you give me a little bit more?
It's a compendium, so I'm going to be writing 25 different true crime stories in short form.
Okay.
Yeah, so a little more narrative.
Well, it's often good if you have an arc of some kind that holds those narratives together rather than just one after another. So. Mm-hmm. For example, when I wrote a book with Greg McCrary, another former profiler, he had a number of cases he wanted to write about. So we created it into an arc that spanned his career and showed you what he was learning along the way. So that by the time he got to a certain part of his life and he was prepared for a very difficult international serial killer case because of what he had done earlier in his life. So you get So even though you get distinctly different cases, you get that string all the way through, that this is about his perspective and the things he's learning from it. So if there's a way to do that, I don't know if you have a theme that ties them together.
Yeah,
I don't know what you want to give away, but...
I'd rather not give away too much, but that is what exactly the thing that I'm struggling with right now. So you hit that right on the head. So that's interesting.
Well, you know, the best way to find the theme is to immerse deeply and then, do a bunch of immersion before you go to sleep. Let your brain. I actually wrote a whole book on this. It's called Snap, Seizing Your Aha Moment. And it's a whole book on what you can do to get yourself to the point where you receive those amazing insights. And I've had that happen to me. What I do is I cram and then I go for a walk and my brain just snaps out the stuff I need. So usually the best thing to do is rather than try really hard on it is to put it all in into your brain like a salad and let your brain mix it around and deliver it to you organically what the theme would be.
That's a great idea. I've come up with a few things practicing that sort of not as consciously as you mentioned in Snap, but mm-hmm. I think I need to read that book.
Are you working with an editor or just
yeah,
an idea?
I am. I'm working with HarperCollins, so.
Well, your editor should be able to give you some sense of direction as to what, I mean, if they've already contracted the book, they should have some idea of what they're hoping for, right?
Yeah.
So your editor might be able to, but even if they don't, it still should come from within you. If you really want the joy of writing and discovery to happen during the process of writing, it really should come from within you. And it's there. It's just a matter of letting it come out.
Cool. Well, thank you.
There you go.
You're welcome.
Now you're ready.
Ready to go.
Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Well, it's been amazing. It's always good to talk to you. Again, our guest has been Catherine Ramsland. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thanks so much.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.